Welcome to the Steep Angle Podcast, the podcast fueled by a life of powdered slopes, ripping good single tracks, healthy living, and the tools and people that help us along the way. Energized by motion, exploration, and the celebration of life, we hope you find inspiration in what we share. Be courageous, be curious, and chase your adventure. I'm your host, Daniel, and this is Steep Angle. Everybody, and thanks for tuning in. Today is Thursday, February 25th, 2021, and there's another exciting weekend lined up at Arizona Snow Bowl. This weekend, the Flagstaff Alpine Ski Team will be hosting Giant Slalom, so if you have the need for speed, then come on out and join us for a fun-filled day of sliding on this thing we call snow. Online registration will be open until noon on Friday, February 26th, and there will not be any in-person registration available. So get on your computer and tickle the keyboard to get your registration in on time. Last weekend was the Southern Series Slalom Race, and boy oh boy was it fun to watch all the ripping good skiers of all ages rip down the slopes. If you want to experience the same excitement, then come on out this weekend for some GS fun. Views of the Inner Basin are looking good, but that's not without some avalanche problems. Recent high temps are probably starting to create some decent spring conditions, but with that comes the added loose wet avalanche problem, in addition to the already persistent slab problem on northerly and easterly aspects. Look for rollerballs or pinwheel-like snowballs for evidence of loose wet conditions. Wind slabs are still on the menu, but the high temp freeze-thaw may diminish that problem. But I'd still keep a watchful eye out for evidence of wind slab. For more information on backcountry conditions, visit Kachina Peaks Avalanche Center at kachinapeaks.org. That's kachinapeaks.org for the latest forecast, and travel safely. Well, that's enough for local news. The Benilde teaching style that is used in many private schools around the world has a teaching philosophy that leverages a student's individual learning style to help them be successful, with the motto, "Meet the student where they are." My guest today seems to embody that philosophy during his time as a coach for the Flagstaff Alpine Ski Team, where his coaching philosophy was to meet the athlete where they were on an individual level to help them achieve their full potential. He is now the director of race and beloved member of the Flagstaff Ski Club. Our conversation took place over a Zoom call in an attempt to be respectful of COVID protocols and such, which provided some minor connection issues and some sound challenges. But overall, I think it went quite well. So without further ado, please welcome the legendary Brian Beamer.
Dropping.
Well, Brian, thanks for joining. You come highly revered. So this is certainly
a special,
it's a special treat. You know, when I hear your name spoken on the slopes, it's done so with a sense of reverence. So I really appreciate you joining the podcast. This is really special.
Yep, well, I have some big shoes to follow, I know.
I took the gate judging clinic with you about 2 weeks ago, and it's clear you have quite the passion for the sport. And it seems that passion is kind of the nucleus of the Flagstaff ski and snowboard team that kind of permeates out into the coaches, the athletes, the parents, basically anybody that's involved with the team. You could really sense a level of passion for the sport. What say you about that within the Flagstaff ski and snowboard team?
Well, you know, I certainly do have a passion for the sport of ski racing. I've been involved in it for most of my life. I was probably better at the sport of ski racing than most anything else I've done. So anyway, it is just a sport that I love. And I love to watch kids progress in the sport and learn from it and then just carry it on, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Now you are considered the director of race for the Flagstaff ski team. And we'll get into what that commitment entails and that sort of thing. But before that, I'd like to take a trip down memory lane. Are you originally from Flagstaff?
I am born and raised here in Flagstaff. My father was born and raised here. His mother was the first twin recorded born in the city of Flagstaff in 1898. And her father homesteaded here. His name was Charles Greenlaw. And he was in the lumber industry and came into Flagstaff in 1876.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so it seems like there's a rich history there.
Yep, so we've been here a long time, seen lots of changes in this town. So,
now, at what year or when did you first start skiing? Like, when did that kind of start for you?
You know, I first started skiing in 1965. My folks got us some skis for Christmas, and it snowed that year. And I remember walking around in the front yard of the house with skis on and in the powder. And we did that for about a day. And then Dad took us over to Mars Hill, which was over in Thorpe Park. And they had a little rope tow over there. And so we learned to ski, my brothers and sisters and I, on Mars Hill right here in town. And we skied there for a couple of weeks, just getting the feel of the skis before Dad finally took us up to the ski area skiing. So started a long time ago. There's been lots of changes, at that ski area since then, I can tell you.
Oh, I bet. Now, professional snowboarder Annie Bollinger describes riding on snow as, and I quote, "It's almost like breathing, like the best breath you can take of pure bliss and happiness," end quote. Can you speak to your early experience skiing and how it relates to how Annie Bollinger describes it?
Oh, you know, just, I think anytime you're up on that mountain and riding that chairlift and then just looking at the surroundings around you and then the friends that you have on the mountain, it's just, an experience that everybody should have and nobody should ever forget. So I don't know if that relates quite to what he quoted, but I don't know. Anytime you're there, it's just great.
There's certainly a, I would say, a sense of freedom when you're up on that mountain. Yep. Is that something that you relate to, kind of the sense of freedom that you have up there?
Yep, it is. It's certainly different than being at work every day. in nowadays times, you know, to be able to get up there and just relax, have fun, and enjoy the surroundings, the outdoors, the fresh air. It's just a great place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you must have started either just before or during the advent of the plastic ski boot. How much, or what are some of the most notable innovations that you've seen over the years?
Well, I did start before the innovation of the plastic ski boot. I had leather boots to start with when I learned. Actually, I think I had rubber ones when I first started, a rubber boot. And then we got some leather boots a couple of years later, and they were lace-ups to start with. Then I got a pair of leather buckle-up boots, and the NAU ski team had some Norwegians that came and skied for the ski team. And one of those Norwegians, who was the coach, hooked up with my dad and a couple of friends of ours, and he actually came over to the house and fiberglassed our boots. I remember baking them in the oven, watching this coach from Norway fiberglass my leather boots and put resin on them, and into the oven they went and cooked for about an hour. And I was one of the first kids in Arizona with a fiberglass boot that was stiff, and I held on to those for a long time. But the plastic boots And the stiffness of them laterally and the flex on them forward have made a huge difference in skiing over the years. So, and I learned that at a young age. I think I was probably 10 when we did that, fiberglass my boots. So they were ugly. People pointed and laughed at them, but I had the stiffest boots on the hill other than the Norwegians. So
for those that were laughing, yeah. let the performance do the talking.
Right. Well, we tried. Some of those kids were hard to compete against too, but I usually held my own okay.
Yeah. Now, you spoke to some of the early memories of when you started skiing, and you talked about Mars Hill. What was your experience like when you first really went up the mountain?
When we first went up the mountain, I have two sisters and two brothers, so we had a pretty large family, and we had a small Toyota Land Cruiser at the time, an older one, so we would all pile into that Land Cruiser, and Dad would run us up the mountain, and times were tough back then with five kids, so Dad would buy himself a ski ticket or a lift ticket, and then he'd get one chairlift ticket for us kids and get a couple of rope tow tickets for the rest of us. And then we'd all ski on the rope tow until it was our turn to go get on the chairlift with them. And we'd trade jackets because the chairlift ticket was on one jacket for the kids. And so we'd get to ride the chairlift with Dad for a couple of runs. And we'd usually just go to Midway on the Agassiz lift at the time because we were young, and get our two runs in up there and then back to the rope tow, which was right down in front of the ski team shacks right now is where it was at that time, across the road that we take to go down to North Star. And it stopped right at the bottom of that last steep pitch on Agassiz run. So, but we'd play around out there all morning long on that rope tow and then get our few runs in on the chair. And anyway, those were some of the first memories, was riding that rope tow and then waiting for our chance to get on the chairlift with Dad. So it was tons of fun.
Yeah. Do you consider those moments on the chairlift with your dad special moments? Because like when I shared the lift with my son, I can't think of anywhere else I'd rather want, you know, rather be than on that lift with him.
Yeah, no, they were special moments. And, you know, Dad grew up skiing at the Snow Bowl too. And so he just always had lots of stories to tell. And so whenever you would get on the chairlift, you'd hear about the old stories of when him and some friends of his would hike up in the afternoon to a cabin that was up on the hill called Spruce Cabin. And it was right up at the top of Tiger and the top of the Meadows. There was a cabin up there, and they'd go up there and they'd spend the night in Spruce Cabin overnight, and they'd freeze to death. He'd say they'd get up in the morning and be the first ones down to the lodge waiting for Al Grassmoan to get there and light a fire so they could all get warmed up and have some breakfast. So we would just hear lots of stories like that on the chairlift all the time.
Yeah, those sound like great stories. Now, fast forward a little bit. When did you start getting involved with competitive skiing?
You know, I started competitive skiing in 1968, maybe 67 it was, when I raced my first race at the Snow Bowl. And I'll never forget that. It was a slalom race that came down Agassiz Run, and it was on skiers left of Agassiz, and it started right at the very top, and the finish line was right down in front of our shacks. And boy, I remember it was my turn to race, and I took off down that race course and was just flying. You know, my eyes were watering, I was going so fast, and I went flying by that finish line and was just so happy with myself. And all of the timers at the bottom were yelling at me to get back up here, get back. And I missed the finish line. So I stayed on the outside of it. And I thought I had done good, but they made me hike all the way back up there and go around through that finish line. So I ended up getting last place on my very first race. And I had a pretty good run. I probably would have done okay, but I missed it. And I've never done that again, missed the finish line. That was the first and only time. But I've seen lots of young athletes on our team do the very same thing. So I don't feel so bad telling a story. You know, normally I'd be embarrassed talking about something like that. But it happens.
Yeah, I guess watching other skiers do it kind of lessens the blow of it a little bit. Like you're in good company.
Yep. I've done it. So.
So you were there.
That was one. Oh, go ahead.
So you were there during the early years of the team, of the formation of the team.
I was. I'm not exactly sure what year they actually started the actual team, but I know I was there during the early years of it. And we had a great ski club even back then. We had some influential people that got our club started, and we started out in the Far West division of the USSA. And races were so far to get to in the Far West over in California and up into Utah. So these guys petitioned us into the Rocky Mountains back in, I think it was 68 or 69, and we've stayed there since, which was a good move for our club to get out of the Far West division and into the Rocky Mountain division. So, but, you know, it was a small club back then, but we had a lot of good skiers, a lot of good families involved and got this thing going. So it's been a great deal for me.
Yeah, no, there's a very rich legacy that I've noticed. How much do you feel has changed between the team when it started to today? Can you speak to some of that?
You know, there's actually probably a lot of similarities in the team with, you know, great families and great people involved, good numbers of kids and the area relations that our team has had have been good from the inception of the team, I know. So, you know, there's a lot of things that really haven't changed. The skiing style and the equipment and maybe the numbers and the cost have certainly changed of everything that we've done, but I guess that's all relative. I don't know. Back then, we were all one big happy family in this ski team. My best friends were on the team, and my coaches were just excellent role models for us, or for myself and everybody else. And still to this day, you think back to things that your coaches told you. So I don't know that much has changed other than the techniques and the equipment and maybe the size of our team. So
what are some of the biggest changes to techniques?
The technique, really, I guess the end result is a good ski racer wants to carve a turn. And so the technique changed with the change of the skis from a straighter, longer ski to a shaped ski, where you didn't have to have as much up and down motion with your hips, knees, and ankles to make a ski turn. Nowadays, you can point your knees one direction and keep the weight on both skis, and those skis will make a turn and carve. Where years ago, we did more individual leg turns at a time, where all of your weight was on one ski to make a turn. And in fact, there was times when one ski was off the snow, we were picking up an inside ski as we were making turns. So, and that's probably the biggest change, is the weight transfers aren't as pronounced as they used to be.
Right.
So.
Now, looking back at those competitive years, if I were to ask you to to brag a little bit about your performance and your successes. What would those be?
I feel I had a lot of successes over the years in skiing, but when I was about 14 through the years of 17, I qualified for the Western States Junior Championships representing the state of Arizona. The structure of ski racing was a little different at that time, and we participated, my team members and I, for 4 years at that event. And the events were held in Aspen, Colorado, Casper, Wyoming, and Taos, New Mexico. Maybe we were at Aspen twice for those, but I was one of six male athletes from the state of Arizona to be able to attend those. And we competed against Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, Utah, California. Just being able to qualify for those was just one of my better achievements, I think. We competed against some tough teams. Colorado had so many ski racers at the time that they were able to field two teams to go to that event. They had an A and a B team. So they were pretty tough to compete with, but the little old team from Flagstaff held its own pretty well. So anyway, it was fun.
Very good.
It was fun. Those were good times back then.
Now, when
I continued ski racing even after those years. I continued ski racing just in the local races here at the Snow Bowl, and then signed up for the Colorado Pro Ski Tour once I turned 18, and did a couple of stints, couple of years of racing in the pro circuit over in New Mexico and Colorado. I never had a bunch of success at it, but had a lot of fun doing it, so it was fun.
What were those years like in the Pro Tour? I mean, I'm sure it's not, it sounds like you had a great time doing it. But in terms of, I guess, was it more challenging at that level than it was when you were under 18?
I don't know if it was more challenging or not. All the way through, I mean, the level of athletes that we all participate against has always been very good. When we traveled as a kid into Colorado or New Mexico for races, we were always racing tough, talented young athletes. And then once I got onto that pro tour, then a lot of the people we were racing against were former U.S. ski team or foreign ski team nationals. And we learned a lot and got humbled a little once we started going to those events, but it was fun. And we just tried our hardest and went out and had a good time racing in those pro tour events. So, but I don't know if it was, if the competition was more challenging or not. It's always been challenging. So, right. Yep.
I'm getting a little bit of feedback on my end. Is it possible for you to turn down the volume just a little bit?
Sure.
Great. That's great. Thank you. Now, when I speak to other athletes that are now coaches about their experiences on ski team, they talk a lot about the things that ski team provided beyond just being an athlete. So they talk a lot about, there are a lot of life lessons that they took away from being an athlete. Can you speak to some of what your experiences in terms of the life lessons that you took away as an athlete?
Yeah. As an athlete, I think some of the lessons you learn is just to be able to believe in yourself. And I think that was one of the most important things, that if you thought you could do something, that you could. And And then that no goal that you set was too high to reach if you really wanted it. And I don't know, ski racing being an individual sport like it is, even though we're part of a team, if you wanted to do something and set the goal, the ski team gave us the tools to get out there and do that. And then I just think they carried over in life, whether it was at your school life, just your social life, and what your goals in the future were going to be after school came. And I think that ski racing helped you realize that nobody's going to do it for you. No one's going to get in there and run that slalom course or change your time. You're going to have to get in there and do it yourself. And I think those are the lessons that carried over, even though they might be in the back of each athlete's mind that they don't really know that's happening, but it is happening because you are doing it yourself. So that's what I think.
Yeah. So it sounds like a healthy level of confidence along with a deep understanding of effort equals reward.
Yep. It does. And, Not every time were there successes, you know. There were failures at times too, but you learned from them and learned how to get up and get going again after those happened. And those are lessons that, gosh, I need to keep learning those. I need to keep applying those lessons in life today, I guess.
So now you mentioned that you competed beyond just the age group. So you did the pro thing for a little bit. How long did you do that for before you decided, okay, I'm competing, it's kind of behind me now?
Yeah, well, you know, I did it for about 3 years. And it wasn't full time, but I did it for about 3 years. And then I started coaching for the ski team. And that's when I really started enjoying the sport even more, was once I started helping young athletes to achieve better success in the sport of ski racing and just having fun doing it. So, but I think I continued to compete even as a young coach. I was chasing athletes down the hill. I was forerunning the course and just trying to set standards for them to try to follow, you know? So I don't know. I'd like to say I can still compete, but these young guys are much faster than I am now.
Well, I don't know. You and I, we shared a chairlift together, and I had a hard time keeping up, to be honest.
Yeah. You were right behind me. I noticed that.
So whatever you got, you still got it. So don't sell yourself short, for sure. Now, can you speak to how did you find the transition from athlete to coach? Were there some challenging moments during that time?
You know, there certainly are. There's lots of challenging moments. You know, every athlete is different. So athletes create challenging moments for you up there on the mountain when you're training them. And the number of parents that you're working with create challenging moments at times. But I guess those same challenges were there with my coaches when I was a kid, but I didn't think it was that tough because I had some really good coaches when I was on the team here in Flag. And I just, while I was up there doing it, I recalled numerous things that my coaches had done to make us better skiers, to make us better people, to make us better sports on the hill. And I just tried to relay those things that I learned through my years of being coached to the athletes on the hill. And I think that paid off more than anything. It was just going back to experiences I had as a young athlete on the team.
Yeah, it sounds like It sounds like you may have developed or maybe borrowed some techniques or habits from your predecessors to kind of help with your coaching success. Can you speak to some of those techniques or habits that you borrowed from the past during your coaching years?
Yeah. One of the techniques or habits was just to actively listen to each athlete every chance I got, to get on the chairlift with them and then listen to those athletes because they're all so different. I mean, I could stand there and talk about bending your knees and making a pole plant and carving a turn, but sometimes I could get better performance out of a kid if I listened to them and learned what their dog's name was and what they ate for breakfast this morning and how hard they could throw a softball, or just learn about the athlete and talk about things that they wanted to talk about during your moments that you weren't actually physically training or working on drills. And I think that our friendships developed more just learning about each individual kid and what they like to do. And because of that, we had a bonding and a trust where once we started to work on drills and learning the sport of skiing and getting better at it, that they applied themselves more when I just became one of their friends, I think. So, and I think I had a couple of coaches that really did that for me too. And it just carried over. So
kind of developing a level of intimacy, for lack of a better term, or friendship with the athlete, I guess is what drove much of your coaching success.
Yep, it did. And by developing that friendship and knowing each athlete individually, when we'd get to a big race, we'd go to the Junior Olympics in the Rocky Mountain Division, where the Central Division was coming with particular athletes. And, you know, they're nervous. They're at a big race. They're racing some of the fastest kids they've ever seen in their life. And by knowing the athlete and what made them comfortable, I could ease their nerve tension some. And by doing that, I could get a top level performance out of young athletes just because we had a trust in each other. And of course I built up their confidence. I let them know they could do it. You guys put your pants on one leg at a time, just like this kid from Central Division or from Vail, Colorado does. So we're all the same here. We're even right now.
It's a level playing field.
Anyway, it's a level playing field. Yeah. So.
Now, when you think back to those coaching years, what stands out? Are there moments that stand out where you look back and you think to yourself, yeah, this is why I love coaching?
Whew, there's a lot of them with the number of athletes that I've worked with over the years with this club. It happens every year when you watch a young athlete just ski like he's never skied before, win their first race, or just progress throughout the year. I don't know. That's a tough question. There's so many of those times that I don't know. I can't say it one specific yet. You know, there's just a lot of them.
Oh, I bet with the amount of years that you've spent just coaching and just with the sport in general, I'm sure there's a whole library of those moments. And speaking with the other athletes that are now coaches, their feedback was that they knew they had arrived as an athlete when they became part of your team. Like, to them, being on your team was okay. I've gone to the next level. What can you speak to that? To what what some of their feedback has been, specifically with, you know, with your team?
Right. Well, you know, when I was 11 years old, we had a new coach come into Flagstaff and started working for the Flagstaff ski team. And he came up and he basically had some tryouts, and he selected 12 athletes that were going to be on his team out of the whole team. And he didn't know any of us. He just watched us ski, and he selected these 12 athletes. And I was fortunate to be one of them. My sister was fortunate enough to be one of them, my older sister. So when I started coaching the Flagstaff ski team, I didn't select athletes from the group of field and said, it's just going to be you 12 that are going to come and ski with me or be on my team like my coach did. But I selected I started skiing with the top group of athletes. And as athletes would get better and better and better, I'd keep bringing on more. And then we just kept increasing the coaching staff to accommodate that size. It's pretty easy to determine who you were going to pick or who you really wanted to work with on the team from watching them ski. But we have a lot of fast skiers, so it's pretty easy to do these days to select some of those young kids. But I was happy to get a lot of them too. There's been some phenomenal fast skiers from this club, and a lot of those current coaches on that staff up there are definitely some of them. Well, I don't want to single them all out, but they're fast.
there's certainly a lot of fast athletes, especially after watching them this last weekend during the Southern Series race. It's impressive to watch. It really is.
Yeah, it is. I think your son Mateo did pretty well too, if I remember right.
Yeah,
I watched him ski.
I think it was on the second Sunday, his first run. He kind of did a little. I think he caught an edge and kind of did a little little twirl. But he really recovered.
Yep, he did. He did. He had some good times too. If I remember right.
Yeah, he didn't let that shake him.
Yeah, that was he. Was he nervous to go out of that top starting gate?
Even though
we moved him down to the lower one,
I'll tell you a funny anecdote. So the Friday before, I was skiing with Kyle and Brooke, the Wormsbeckers, and Brooke asked me if Mateo. She asked me the same question: does Mateo get nervous at the start gate? And to be honest, I didn't know how he felt. So when he came down the ski run, you know, we're waiting for all the kiddos there, and he came down. So I figured, well, I guess I'll ask him. So I asked Mateo, I go, Mateo, do you get nervous up there at the start gate? And his response was, no, I just went for it.
So, yeah.
You know,
I bet he was.
It was one of those from the mouth of babes kind of responses, which was pretty classic, actually.
Right. Yeah.
Now, what would you tell, say, an upcoming athlete that is kind of on the cusp of kind of going to that next level? You know, they visibly have the talent, but for whatever reason, they themselves don't believe it. What would you tell that athlete to kind of help them overcome their apprehension?
Well, I think that a lot of that would depend on the athlete that I'm talking to. Once I got to know that athlete by riding a chairlift with them and learning more about him, I mean, some athletes you might tell them different things than you would tell another athlete. To get them to move on. But I would certainly build their confidence by by letting them know that I believed in them and what they were doing, and that their level is just improving every day. And you can go as far as you want to in this sport if you work hard at it. You know, some of those athletes, you may have to tell them that in order to move on, it may be strength and conditioning that's going to make the change for them. Some of it may be all just tactical changes in the line that we're running in the course, or in a race course. And that can be addressed by additional training time and more gate time and more. Some of them may be, we need to get out and go free skiing more a little bit and do some things. So there's a number of things you can do to have those athletes like that move forward, but it could be different in every circumstance. So it's hard to say on which athlete you might do one thing or another. So that's where good coaches come into play, and people like the current staff up there that we have. You mentioned Davis and Charlie and Aaron. Kyle is a phenomenal coach. Hope to get him back here soon. But anyway, good coaches, they have a different way of treating each of those situations, and all of us might do it a little different, but it's hard to say one specific thing.
So depending on the athlete, it requires more of a individualized touch, rather than a one-size-fits-all kind of technique.
Yeah. I think it does for sure. And, you know, and I learned that from my coaches, I think, you know. They had myself and my other teammates, we progressed, and I think they talked to us all a little bit different depending on what we needed more as an athlete. So tried to do the same thing. And having multiple good coaches certainly helps, because one coach may see something in an athlete that another coach misses. And if you're able to portray that to an athlete in the proper way, good things can happen quick. So.
Yeah. Now, how much do you think the athlete has evolved in your many years involved with the sport? For example, my sport growing up, I was a diver. When I look at the divers today, the degree of difficulty of stuff that they're doing today is just, it's beyond anything I would have imagined back when I was diving. Have you seen kind of a similar evolution in the athlete? Like they've gotten stronger, they've gotten faster. Can you speak to what some of that evolution may be?
Yeah. Well, you know, it certainly has evolved with the new equipment that we're all skiing on. The skis are so much more responsive and so much quicker. The basis materials that we're using are faster now. The surfaces that we're skiing on are machine groomed with machine made snow, which is faster and harder than the natural stuff. And so the athletes have had to get stronger, and because they're stronger, they're just quicker. The speeds are so much greater now than they were when I was racing. So they certainly had to change. I think the current athletes are just physically and mentally stronger than we were back then, just to be able to handle those. I don't know if you watched those ability class girls run at that race this last weekend. And I mean, those gates are coming at those kids just fast. They're just coming at them, and their reflexes are just lightning quick compared to what we used to be. And that's where that technique we talked about a little had changed too, where before we had more up and down movement to make a ski turn, where nowadays they don't have time to move up and down. They can point their knees and get the skis on the new edge and they just turn, and things were coming at them fast. So a lot less body movement now than we used to have. So Yeah, lots of changes.
Yeah, that ability class was that was impressive to watch. It really was.
Yeah. Then I sit and I watched that, and then we moved our way down to the U8s, and then I watched some of those athletes, and I just can't wait for the day when those are going to be the athletes that we saw in the ability class. You know, and it's going to happen. Those only they're going to be even quicker. Things are going to change that much more. It'll be quicker.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
And for them, it'll probably be just second nature. You know, it'll just be like, we do what we do.
Yeah, this is it. That's another slalom at the snow bowl.
Yeah, exactly.
Another flush, another hairpin.
How much of what we've learned in the last 15 to 20 years about like fitness and nutrition and that sort of thing, how much of that we've learned has impacted the performance of athletes today?
Well, I'm sure it's impacted them a lot. I remember I was at a race camp up in Grand Targhee, Wyoming one summer with a bunch of pro ski racers as coaches up there. And I took a team of kids here from Flagstaff up to that summer race camp and was talking to the nutritionalist that worked with the U.S. ski team at the time. And Phil and Steve Mayer were the overall World Cup champions. They were my idol. They were on the ski team and Olympic winners. And anyway, these guys were some of the best in the world. And that nutritionist that was working with the U.S. ski team had them on a special diet and monitored everything they did from week to week and thought that, man, whatever we're doing, it is working. We have to keep it up. And then he found out at the end of the season that every night after dinner and after the video training sessions that they were doing, Phil and Steve were down in the kitchen making dinner, cooking whatever they wanted. So I think that nutrition has something to do with it, but I think the important thing is that the athletes get nourishment in their body and proteins and drink lots of water, and good athletes are going to be good athletes. So nutrition certainly does help, but I don't know if it's changed performance a whole lot just based on that nutritionalist conversation. And that was a number of years back, so it may have changed more since then. So just make sure that their belly's full so they have the energy to move on.
That's right. So,
yeah.
How much do you miss coaching?
You know, I miss coaching a whole lot. And I love being around the athletes up there, and I could still go up and coach, but it's hard to do on a part-time basis. I think that the athletes deserve to have a coach that they can say is their coach. And I've always been kind of a take charge type of guy. And if I go up there and start coaching, I could start stepping on our current coach's toes some, and I don't want to do that because those relationships are getting built between those athletes and their coach. And if I was able to move back into it full time, I certainly would, because that is fun and I really enjoy doing it. Watching those kids progress and teaching them things. That's what I like to do, but I don't want the athletes to not know who their coach is. So, and that's hard. That's a challenge for me to go up there to a ski race like we were at last weekend and not want to step in and do, let me take over course inspection here, coach. You know, and those coaches we have are doing a perfect job, but I would like to take over and tell them a few things, but I don't. I try to not do that.
So it's kind of letting that next generation kind of continue that legacy, that coaching legacy of Flagstaff's
team. Yeah.
Which you know, when I hear them talk about their experience as an athlete and now that they're coaches, I feel like you had a lot to do with that, with how they are as a coach, as an individual, as, you know, just as a person. There's certainly the, from viewing it through my eyes, kind of from the outside looking in kind of thing, there's certainly a continuation of the Brian Beamer legacy among the coaching staff. It's very special to watch.
Those are a bunch of good young coaches that we have, for sure. Lots of fun. And it's one of the rewarding things of coaching is seeing the successes that all of your young athletes are going to achieve in their life, and so many of them do it. The ones coming from the sport of ski racing just end up being good people all the way around. And that's, not only are we trying to just make them good little ski racers, but we want to make them good citizens. And I think that's what we've done with a lot of athletes. And I know that they're up there just continuing that. They really are. So,
yeah, it seems like it kind of speaks to the life lessons that are learned through the sport. Like you said, kind of developing good citizens. You are the, in terms of your involvement with the team now, you are the director of racing for the Flagstaff Ski Team. Can you speak to what that commitment entails?
Well, I just oversee the races or the events that we put on in the Alpine side for the club. And the sport of ski racing it's got a big, thick rule book. And we have a number of certified officials from within our club. And as the chief of race or director of racing, my job is to make sure that we put on a number one safe event for all those athletes. Because we don't want to injure somebody outside of just the normal risk of skiing. And then I want to make it a fair event for all of the athletes, and then a fun event. So that's the goal of mine as the director of racing. And I don't know if you noticed, but there, just on the event up there this weekend, there was 35 people involved on our personnel sheet that it took to put that event on like it was. And a lot of people might think it's something very simple, but it takes a lot of people in positions specific to pull off an event like that. Our timing and calculations people are key to make sure that we have a fair event. You can't miss any times. You've got to have accurate timekeeping. So we have primary and backup electronic timing systems that are all homologated or certified through the FIS, where our equipment we use, we could put on the Olympic race and run it fairly, just like they're doing at the Olympics. And then our race administrator, just the one who's compiling the results and making sure that what we're putting down on paper is proper, and that you don't have someone who got third who ends up getting a gold medal or something like that. So that's all part of making it fair. And your referee and your chief of courses that are in there, they're following the rule book. They're watching every fault or anything that may happen on the course to make sure we run it by the rules to make it fair for everyone. And that's what I basically do now, is oversee that whole portion of the events. And that's fun too. It really is. We have a lot of money and equipment invested, our club does, and we continue to invest in it. The safety netting that we put up, it's really important for these athletes, especially as fast as they're going nowadays. Even in a slalom event like that, to keep an athlete from falling and going into the woods is most important thing I think about every day when I'm up there watching that event. Those are the things I look at first thing in the morning. And it'll be very important for the giant slalom coming this weekend, Saturday, that's running down Phoenix. The protection along the siding in specific areas, you'll see it doubled where we have an additional layer of protection in specific areas. And those are things that we're looking at, and Davis is looking at with me as a chief of course. And he's very good at what he does too, Davis is. So he learned all that from his dad and myself up there. And so Davis and I can kind of read each other's mind when we're inspecting a course up there. We know we're both looking at the same things all the time. So it's fun. So, but we have a great crew of certified officials and volunteers from within our club. And we always have, and they, over the years that I've been involved, we've had different people in these positions for anywhere from 3 to 7 years at a time. And then as the families, the kids get older and athletes, and we have new ones coming in. So we're continuously training people on it. So what type of position are you interested in?
I'm still getting to know the club a little bit better. It's actually one of the reasons why I do the podcast, because I feel like it's a great way to get to know folks like yourself, like Davis and Liz and that kind of thing on a bit more personal basis than just being a parent that shows up with their kid on the mountain.
Right.
So yeah, I'm kind of slowly getting to know the team a little bit better, on a more, I guess, intimate level, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I don't know, see where that takes me, and maybe find some niche that I feel passionate about that I could take on.
Yeah.
But for now, it's more of a just kind of watch and learn. That sort of thing. Cause I'm also pretty new to the sport, the competing side of it as well. So I feel like I have a lot to learn there. I feel like,
we appreciate you.
Yeah, no,
I was gonna say, we appreciate your help up there this last weekend, game judging.
Oh yeah.
That's an important job, and it's a tough job.
Yeah. I find Rob to be a very helpful resource for that kind of thing. So I'm kind of slowly learning about the competition side, like through him. And so like there was an incident, I believe it was on Saturday. I made a call that someone missed the gate and it was overturned. So I kind of asked Rob, like, okay, well, what does that process look like? Like, how does something like that get overturned? Just for my level of understanding of kind of how the rules work and that sort of thing. There's a lot of great resources, a lot of great people on the team that are very willing to share. Putting on an event like that, like you did this last weekend, you know, a lot of moving parts to it. A lot of kind of spinning plates sort of thing. But boy, oh boy, it runs like a machine for as many moving parts as there are. I mean, you guys really do a great job of putting on an event and, you know, making sure that everything's on time. And it's really impressive to watch the team at work.
It's not always that way. It's not always quite that way, but this last weekend did go very well. But it's a good crew that we have, and there's a number of them. But we've been to a lot of, well, the phone's ringing. It'll quit. Been to a lot of events throughout the Rockies that don't quite go as well. So we pride ourselves in trying to put on the best race and event we can. So.
Well, you certainly did that this last weekend. So kudos to you and everybody involved. It was a really fun event.
It was.
And I imagine that sometimes things will go awry. It's the old saying, man makes plans and God laughs.
Yep.
But hopefully those are few and far between.
Right. Yeah.
So now looking at the future of the Flagstaff ski team, what are some of the hopes that you have for the future of the team?
Well, I hope that our team continues to provide the tools to teach these kids the sport of ski racing, for number one. I hope that our area communications and cooperation with the area remains good. The crowds that we've been seeing are a little troublesome sometimes. Just lift lines are long, and the number of acres that we have to ski on are small. So hopefully we can continue to get good lane space. But with snowmaking that we have, guaranteed ski season with the leadership we've had from our board of directors and the direction they've taken us, we're now a bronze level certified club within the country and one of only 50 in the country, I believe. And the second team in the south of the Rocky Mountain division that has achieved this accommodation just leads me to believe that our successes are still going to be good. We can continue on this route we're traveling, and our club is just going to get bigger and better because of that. And Todd, our president, is the one who is very instrumental in making that bronze level certification happen. And I'm just really proud of that. It puts us right up there with all of the teams in the country. You know, I like to think we have the best team in the Rocky Mountain division right down here in Flagstaff, but some of the Vail and Aspen clubs might argue that they're better than we are, but I don't think so. I think our future is real bright here in Flagstaff, Arizona. And snowmaking has been a big part of it.
Oh, I bet. In talking with Davis and Liz, I mean, they remember days or years or seasons that they didn't get any snow at all, and having to travel, you know, far and wide in order to train and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'd like to drill down a little bit on the bronze medal. What added perks does that add to the team?
Well, I think it just makes our team, just more justified as a team, that we're not just a little bitty ski club working with just a few athletes. We are a major ski club with a number of athletes, with policies and procedures in place, qualified coaching staff and personnel to run it. And one of the biggest things I think it's going to help with is our fundraising, where we're a legitimate team out there and a legitimate place for major sponsors to kick in and help us achieve what we need. Because it does take a lot of money to fund this program. And, you know, we try to keep our coaching fees as low as we can so we can get more participation from more athletes. And that's something that we've always done. So because of that, we need to rely on these sponsors to continue investing in our safety equipment, for one. That safety equipment is very expensive. That I think we have almost $25,000 worth of netting on the hill last week, just for protection of the athletes. And unfortunately, that stuff doesn't last forever. It's continuously needing to be replaced so it remains effective. Our timing equipment that we have is very expensive, like I said, and it's certified through the FIS. And gosh, I just found out last weekend that our equipment supplier, my timing equipment supplier, sent an email to me on Saturday night saying, "Hey, Brian, I see your race on live timing. Looks like you guys are having a great race." And I responded back. He said, "I hope you know that a lot of your equipment's been a run out of certification in 2023. It's like, oh, great. You know, that's a lot of money worth of finished beams and start wands that we may be looking at purchasing here in a couple of years. So anyway, it's expensive to fund our program. So, and I think that that bronze certification just does legitimize our club that much more, where it's going to assist us in our sponsorship revenues that we need to generate to keep our club going.
So in a way, it kind of, it makes the club more bona fide. Now, what are some of the challenges that comes with having the bronze medal? Like, you know, kind of the idea of, okay, we got the bronze medal. Now let's not just rest on our laurels. Let's, you know, let's keep pursuing excellence. Do you feel like that, you know, like there's a little bit more pressure on the team now because of that?
There is. And, you know, our current president and board has been instrumental in making this happen. But as with all youth sport boards, the people change. And one thing we can't do is lose focus on that bronze and what it took to get us there, and then to maintain that level of excellence that we're striving for. We would have a tough time moving up to the silver and gold levels, just because to be a gold level club, you have to be able to run a downhill and a super G, and we don't have the certification of our runs or the hill space to do things like that. But that's okay. We're not here to build downhillers, but we do want to maintain that bronze. And if we could move up to a silver down the road, do that. And I think that's something that's achievable, and that's going to be a good mission and goal for our future club and future administration of the club and coaching staff, is to continue to working for that level of excellence, because in the end, it's going to benefit all of our kids that are on the team. And that's why we're doing it, is for their benefit. So continue to make progress in that way for the athletes. Yeah. Something I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's certainly room for progression.
Yep, there is.
Now, what do you enjoy doing when you're not skiing? What do you do with your spare time?
Well,
doesn't involve sliding on snow.
Well, you know, I work a lot, but you know, I do like getting into the outdoors every chance I get. And I like hunting and I like fishing. So those are my hobbies. I like going to the lake, and but skiing is what I really like to do. I like it when winter time comes. Wish I could do more of it, but this work interferes. So
yeah, it's work tends to get in the way, but it's a means to an end.
Yep, that it is. So yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to enter the portion of the podcast where I'm going to ask you a few questions, just to kind of get to understand a little bit more of Brian, likes, dislikes, that kind of thing. So no wrong answers on these. So we'll just jump right in. Favorite food?
Ribeye steak.
Oh, you're talking my language.
Right, maybe with some fresh roasted green chilies and shredded cheese on top.
Sounds good to me. Yeah, especially a ribeye that's cooked over a proper fire.
That's correct.
Cake or pie?
Pie.
Okay, I know I said there wasn't any wrong answers. That question, there is a wrong answer, but you got it right. So kudos to you.
Okay, good.
along those lines, do you have a favorite?
You know, I think I like lemon meringue.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Pie, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Mom used to make a good one.
Nothing like a homemade lemon meringue pie, that's for sure.
Meringue pie, yep.
Growing up in Miami, so key lime pie was the big
Oh yeah,
The big
those are
one.
good ones too.
Yeah.
Right.
Favorite ice cream flavor?
Pralines and cream.
Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah.
That's the one I like. I haven't had any in a long time. I better get some. I haven't thought about that in a while.
Who would play you in the story of your life? Actor, you know, that sort of thing.
Ooh. Oh, man, I want Davis Boyer, too.
So in addition to all the coaching clinics that he's done, now he needs to take acting lessons.
Yeah.
If you wrote a book, what would you title it?
If I wrote a book, what would I title it? Oh boy, good question. I'd have to think about that. I don't know.
That sounds like a good title. I'd have to think about it.
I'd have to think about that. About the old man and the ski team.
Oh, I like that. That's good. Yeah. First life-changing moment.
First life-changing moment. Another good question. First life-changing moment. I'm drawing a blank. I just am. There's been a number of great moments, but life-changing, I guess a lot of them are, but the first one, I don't know. Let's see. Missing the finish line.
Oh, there you go.
First ski race I heard, you know? That was life-changing.
Yeah.
Never done it again since.
That's right. That's right. You were you were on top of the world when you got to the bottom, only to realize, oops.
That's right. That's right. And it did change my life.
Very good.
Yeah.
Do aliens exist?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. No. You've been the first one. You've been the first one
right?
to say no. Yes. Everyone
they
that
say
I asked.
No.
Yeah. All right. That's
right.
Good.
Okay. Yeah.
Finally, we got a no on the leaderboard now.
All right. Good deal.
But in
I knew
the words,
I
but I will say in the words of Carl Sagan, if it's just us, it seems like an awful waste of space.
Right.
That's pretty much it. I really appreciate you joining. This was great. Very insightful. I think a lot of people are going to be jazzed to hear this episode for sure.
Well, good. Thank you, Dan. It was fun doing it.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Yeah. Yeah.
It was
great.
So yeah. Okay. And we'll see you on the mountain this weekend then, huh?
Oh, we'll be up there. We'll be up there for sure.
Okay. And Mateo will be there too.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Yeah. He'll definitely be up there. He'll probably be the first one there.
I'm gonna see how good he is at doing hockey stops.
Ooh, hockey stops.
That's just a good drill for young athletes. Hockey stops on skis.
Okay.
Has he talked about doing hockey stops with his team?
No, not yet. But
oh, yeah, it's a great drill.
But he sure does
great.
He enjoys launching himself off of jumps.
Right. Okay.
For sure.
I'll bet that's like most kids. They like hitting those jumps.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't hit them anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. He's at that point, and I've mentioned this on other podcasts, but he's at that point when he says, "Follow me, Dad." I get a little nervous.
Yep. Yeah. Just wait.
Yeah. No, I know.
A couple more years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was, I can't complain because it was all my doing to begin with. So,
right.
And the team's doing, I mean, I can't take full credit, but definitely nudging him in that direction. I will take credit for
that. It's a fun sport, and you get to participate. You don't have to sit on the bench.
That's right.
You know, while he's doing it, you get to go participate in it. So it makes it fun.
It certainly does. And watching his progression has been, especially this season, has been, as a parent, has been the most rewarding thing to see.
Yeah, good.
You know, yes, he races. He, you know, I enroll him, you know, register him in the races. But I really have no expectation of him being the best.
Right
now, I just, it's more about having fun.
And just
learning the sport, you know,
being
more a student of the sport and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So this season has just been so awesome.
Yep. Good. Glad to hear that.
Yeah. It's been great. Well, again, thanks for joining, Brian. This was really great. And I really look forward to putting this episode out.
Very good. Where do we go to find it?
You could find it on iTunes or Apple Podcasts.
Okay.
And you could just do a search for Steep Angle is the name of the podcast.
Right.
S-T-E.
Right. Okay.
S-T-E-E-P-A-N-G-L-E.
Yep.
It should be like one of the first ones to pop up. And just find us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts and subscribe to us. And yeah, it,
okay.
Looking forward to putting this one up.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you later.
All righty. Well, that's it for this week. Special thanks to my guest, Brian Beamer. If you enjoyed the show and want to stay up to date with future shows, then find us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts and hit that subscribe button. If you want to support the show and you do your shopping on Amazon, then visit steepangle.com. That's steepangle.com. Click on the Amazon banner on our homepage, bookmark the link for future use, and continue with your Amazon shopping. It won't cost you anything, and it's a way to show us a little love. Speaking of support, emotional support is provided by food, wine, and a house full of love. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time, bye for now.